This is the Limitless, the podcast between. It's a return conversation with Luke Dodson. How's life in Canterbury?
Yeah, it's for this little isolated node of consciousness, it's quite tired physically from working all day, taking people on boat rides, which is now open. That's an interesting one, because that is all kind of saturated with the kind of general. My work is now saturated with sort of COVID paranoia, as I would put it.
The people you work with, you mean?
Yeah, and the sort of the regulations.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I mean, maybe I'm being judgmental to call it COVID paranoia, but it seems that way to me.
Mm.
We have to disinfect the boats after each ride, and we have an option, either if there's more than two people in a boat, which means that you have to have them a little bit closer to you. You have the option of either wearing a mask, which I'm not happy about, if only from a sheer comfort perspective, is the one time I tried to wear a mask on a boat out of sort of duty and pressure, I fell in the water. Not an accident there. But the other option is I give them an umbrella to hold above their heads so that any virus that I breathe out won't catch them. And
you mean like an umbrella that comes over their faces, kind of?
Yeah, well, they'll be sort of. I'm at the back of the boat, and they're sitting in front of me with their backs to me, so they.
People, I see it behind, right, a shield.
Shield, yeah. And really weird. And it's quite, I find it quite unsettling now to be in a circumstance where there's a general acceptance of that narrative and how I negotiate that. And I've generally kept myself fairly quiet about what I think, and just been very fairly vague. And you know, I was chatting to a colleague today and he was saying, oh, you know, people should just have to do this little bit for the common good of wearing a mask when they go into a shop. And I was saying, well, I've seen evidence on both sides, and I'm not really sure what to think.
Hmm.
But my suspicion is that there's something. I do think there is something going around that's making people ill. I think there's lots of things.
Mm-hmm.
Could be a virus called COVID-19. Sure, why not? I don't know. I'm not a virologist. I don't know about these things. But I'm really unsettled by the sort of going along with this hysteria. It's been quite a troubling thing to experience, actually, directly firsthand, working in an environment where it's just like, yes, you know, you've got to spray down the boats, and you've got to, you know, avoid the branches that other boatmen brush on because you might catch it from them.
Sure.
Yeah. So how is everything in Hope?
Well, I suppose it's a little bit similar, perhaps not, I mean, not to the same degree, I mean, on that particular subject, because we run, you know, we create our own rules, but, and most of the regular local customers I mean, just yesterday, one regular customer came in with a mask and was saying the kind of things you're talking about. We've got to all do our own good, you know, to contribute to the good of all kind of thing. And she didn't seem to be insinuating that I should be wearing a mask. So I haven't felt any pressure so far, even though the way we run our store must be seen as irresponsible to anyone who is pushing what you call the hysteria. But so far, I haven't felt any pressure on us or on me personally to conform. So then it's relatively easy to deal with. And in this encounter, I just listened to her and I just made a small attempt to just say, well, we don't really know, you know, what is good collectively, because you can't really be sure about what the mainstream media is telling us. Yeah, that's as far as I went. And then she left. She didn't have any response to that at all. I mean, she didn't even seem to object or nothing, just kind of water off a duck's back. And then I looked over at a more regular customer and we just exchanged this look. It wasn't even an eye roll, but it was like the eye roll wasn't even necessary. It was just a smile with that ironic tinge to it. And it was a pleasant thing. I mean, that's as long as I can see, you know, the pockets of sanity, then I'm doing all right. But yes, if I was completely surrounded by it, I would get exasperated very rapidly, because it's not just the practical ramifications, is it? It's the mimetic thing and realizing that people are believing something without questioning it and letting it regulate their behaviors, and they're getting pulled into possibly mass hysteria, but I don't also want to brand anything, but certainly mimetic behavior that is not referring to any kind of individual conscious questioning. You know, it's blind. And I think you know, my position is quite untenable, because it's almost as though, when you were talking, it's almost as though I would have to say, well, actually, I don't believe in serving the collective good, which isn't actually true. I very much do, but somehow on these terms I don't, because on these terms I'm like, well, even if there is a virus, let it rip, let it wipe out as many people as it wants to wipe out. That's my idea of the collective good, as in the collective includes nature, not just human beings, and certainly not just individual human beings, right? But that's, you know, obviously that's a nuance that, I mean, that's a deeply philosophical and spiritual, you know, and that's not that's not a place you can just go to right away, as in, well, you know, if 7.2 billion people die of this, there'll still be 0.6 billion around, so is that... And I don't necessarily think that's a good philosophy, because that's kind of Extinction Rebellion. So it's not as though I would be pushing for that either. Just that I don't know what's good for the collective. As far as I can see, wearing masks and being, you know, driven by fear-based mainstream media is not good for the collective.
Yes, yes. There's huge ramifications to... the broader kind of psychic health from all of these things that are being pushed in various ways. And even if there's no, there isn't necessarily a conspiratorial aspect behind it, to use the dreaded C word there, there isn't sort of some sort of deliberate attempt. And maybe there's a whole, I can fully, fully believe that there's a whole load of incompetence and just improvised policy making of just, oh, with the virus, what should we, got to do something? Well, I don't know. I've got some friends in the mask making business. They could probably, you know, use a bit of our money and we'll help them. And then, you know,
it's the blind leading the blind, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. And there's always that space of nuance that is really nice to read. You're writing things like, you know, the psychological operatives in Hollywood series, just mapping out that in-between territory, that liminal territory, where, yeah, there's aspects of conspiracy, but there's also aspects of just
incompetence and delusion.
Yeah, but there is something really disturbing at an energetic level, I find. And there was, I saw an interesting talk recently that Franz Rupert gave, and I my mum actually sent it to me, and then I'd recognised him from having been a liminalist guest as well. But he was talking about the nature of this pandemic from trauma, the perspective of trauma psychology, and the way in which face coverings and you know, lockdowns and social isolation, or even if there may be good faith behind these policies, which I kind of doubt, but there may be, and there may be arguments to be made that, you know, well, masks catch droplets, which means that they don't, you know, not spreading things so much, and there's all of that. But there's something there that I found watching this talk really quite powerful, because it connected to something that I've actually just been really, really upset since having gone back to work, and since having been exposed to all of this kind of fear and, you know, enforced, obligated OCD behavior of wiping things down with antibacterial, which is...
Yeah, a world run by Howard Hughes.
Yeah, exactly. Start driving around in private jets called the Spruce Moose or whatever it is. And it's been upsetting. It's like I've been sort of struck with moments of real sadness and anxiety and just weeping, and these really powerful dreams of quite disturbing material coming up. And I feel that on some level I'm kind of starting to partake of some collective emotional state, and I'm responding to it in my own particular way rather than going along with it, as, you know, a lot of people are, and also rather than taking a really strident oppositional stance to it, as some of my other friends do. I feel more comfortable with, and I feel more comfortable with the kind of really anti-lockdown, anti-vaccination, anti-COVID people, even though I don't also fully identify with that. I try to stay out of that rabbit hole too much, because I'm also aware that there's a game being, as was said in this talk by Franz Rupert, that you're dividing people into these two camps. You know, the mask wearing, socially isolated, locked down, generally socially liberal tribe, not always, but certainly mainstream politically. And then the kind of rebellious anti-lockdown, anti-mask. It's, you know, masks are just a symbol of control, and it's all just this, it's all a big conspiracy. Those people, and that they're kind of at loggerheads with each other. And it's very, very frightening for me at the moment. It's very strange and weird and frightening and upsetting at the moment.
Have you thought about the irony of that this is echoing the anonymous movement, because of course that was the opposite. That was the supposedly subversive uprising of masked protesters. And now you're saying that the mask signifies the mainstream, the mainstream resistance to this, not just the virus, but way of suggesting to the populist uprising that is so threatening also to to the mainstream liberal collective.
And so there's a certain reversal there, as we've also seen with the Black Lives Matter protests and these kinds of supposedly anarchist groups that have been supposedly taking over areas of cities in America. A lot of these people wearing masks because they're fully, you know, fully endorsing the general COVID narrative, because of course it's perfectly acceptable to have mass gatherings as long as it's a protest.
Right. So that's so the Antifa was foreshadowing in a sense, because the Antifa were already wearing the masks for anonymity before the COVID thing.
Yeah, and the Antifa took on the look of the style of the Black Bloc, who I don't really know their true origins, and who knows what's really going on behind the scenes there. But I remember the Black Bloc from 20 years ago when I was sort of in my early adolescence, and my mum was very much involved in kind of Reclaim the Streets and the anti-globalization movement. And there was a sense that, yeah, the Black Bloc were kind of our side. They were our team, wearing masks and over their face and sort of black hooded tops, so that they all had this anonymous sort of appearance. And that has been, if there was anything authentically rebellious there at all, in the beginning, which I don't know, but it's certainly any spontaneity has been thoroughly squeezed and diverted into this bizarre kind of neo sort of pseudo anarchist movement of the Antifa, which appears to be the kind of stormtrooper division of, you know, the CIA backed Democrat wing of the American ruling class, to the point where you get someone like, I was really fascinated by the Capitol Hill autonomous zone situation that broke out about a month or so ago when all the BLM protests were happening in earnest. And this area was taken over by what appeared to be a mix of really, really incredibly naive, generally white American sort of college leftists, or wannabe leftists, lots of very disorderly crackhead type people, and then very, very potentially quite dangerous militant types as well, and kind of gangbangers and criminals. They were apparently led by this guy called Raz Simone, who drove around the area in a Tesla, handing out AR-15s to people, and had an interview in Forbes magazine, which was a glowing interview, really praising him.
Why were they interviewing him?
Out of the interest generated by the Capitol Hill autonomous zone, ostensibly anyway, that they interviewed him as being he was described as being a warlord. But I think you need to actually see some genuine warfare in order to a proper warlord. I mean, this was a bit of civil conflict, and there were some weapons around.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing really like.
But he was described glowingly as a warlord.
Yeah, it was sort of the alleged warlord Raz Simone, who's, you know, this actually quite very wealthy entrepreneur and rapper, who had all these, you know, interesting ideas about the future of policing and the future of politics in America. And Forbes magazine was interviewing this guy and, you know, describing him as this incredibly thoughtful, intelligent man. And he may well be to talk to, but why are Forbes saying that? That's very strange. I mean, Forbes is, you know, the business magazine. No anarchist revolutionary of the, you know, the early 20th century would have been interviewed by something like Forbes magazine. I can't imagine, you know, Ukrainian anarchist Nestor Makhno, who fought against both the white and red sides in the Russian conflict, would have been treated that way. There must be something, to me it seems obvious that there's something else going on here. Mm-hmm. And my little pet theory was that the defund the police movement was partly about doing away with the old police, mm-hmm. and say, right, okay, as you say about the controlled demolition of the economy, well, we have also a controlled demolition of the police force, because that's mm-hmm. all, that's old fashioned now. We'll have a new form of policing, which we won't even call policing, but will be probably algorithmically generated and, you know, involving various kinds of high-tech AI sort of fourth industrial revolution type technology.
Including police robots,
yeah. And presumably they'd have to, but they have to be woke police robots. They'd have to be, you know, train them.
Well, they'd be algorithmically correct, wouldn't they?
Yeah. Then you have the issue that sometimes the algorithms can end up being racist.
So unconsciously, right? Because the programmer was unconsciously racist.
Yeah. you have to program the racism out of them. And so, yeah, that whole movement struck me as being very, very suspect. As soon as they started saying that it was okay to attend a protest because racism was a bigger pandemic than COVID, I was like...
Yeah, that's the tell, isn't it? Yeah, and it's... Again, the divide and conquer thing, it seems to be getting, like, ground down like plutonium, so it's getting more and more pervasive, because, for example, I mean, the idea that police are not good guys and that maybe they should be given less power, the thought that I would... that think that the landscape would have changed so much that I would be objecting to that.
Yeah.
Right? And that somebody who was espousing that would have become, I mean, I would feel like, well, wait a minute. Well, I guess you've just summed it up quite well, but there's an awful lot of background information that person or that discussion would need in order to avoid schismogenesis. Because if you just say, well, wait a minute, you know, the police aren't that bad, which isn't kind of what I want to say, right? But they're not as bad as the thing that is coming, kind of thing. Mm. And why, you know, why are the, I mean, you and I know, but my point is simply that this did come up recently with somebody in an Oshana group, and he just brought it up as an example. And also the Black Lives Matter came up briefly on an affinity group around Oshana people as an example. And in both cases, they're like, the sense is, okay, their ideological affiliation is such that Black Lives Matter is a good thing, and it's a sign that something good is coming out of this COVID thing. What? And that anyone who's objecting, it was a joke, it was a meme or whatever, that if you think a shortage of toilet paper was tough, wait until you're trying to find a policeman. right? And this person was citing that as example of some ignorant, you know, hick redneck guy who thinks the police are great, right? So it's the landscape's moving so fast. It's like, well, how do you engage? How do I actually engage with that point? It's you know, it's almost impossible, really, without having the deep context, which I don't have. You seem to be better versed. I just got a footnote in 16 Maps of Hell about this, because there is a chapter about the police and the militarization of the police over the past couple of decades in the US, and how they've become more and more like an occupying army domestically. They're acting more and more like an occupying army does in a third undeveloped nation in the boundaries of the US itself, which would be consistent with them being a corporate proxy army of some sort. So I was just referring to that, but also to the Antifa thing, the irony of this, that this supposedly progressive movement is being endorsed and validated by high level politicians. So these two things are happening in parallel, and now they seem to be converging, as you've just laid out. But yeah, all I could do is get a footnote in, because it was all so new and recent. Anyway, so I guess the overriding point to me is, because I don't necessarily want to talk too much about, you know, geopolitics and all that, is I suppose how it's becoming increasingly difficult to talk about what's going on in the world, the more urgency there seems to be to talk about it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a kind of meta point. Maybe it needs unpacking, but I felt that around COVID initially as well. There's something going on here that everybody wants to talk about, including me, but I realized that I could almost say nothing about it without exposing my own ignorance and potentially adding noise. And that hasn't really changed. So I don't know where this is leading, but I think specifically with you and I, as interesting as all this is, I was hoping to talk to you today about your, like I said, your kind of inside experience as you're situated on the alternate media landscape, whatever you can put it in your own terms, but however you're situated there. And I mean, the things that we've compared notes on in our email exchange around this, like how easy it is to get ideologically pigeonholed, one thing, and potentially blacklisted because of being affiliated with one side or another on the one hand, and on the other hand, so the flip side of that, how the people doing that are themselves pigeonholing themselves. Also, I use the example of Eric Davis. He's potentially so afraid of being affiliated with anything right wing that he will double down and kind of attack or resist or block any kind of information that is tainted by association with one ideological set. So that whole, and how that, and the last point, I guess, is how that can turn people into unwitting operatives. They're not even, they haven't really been co-opted in the sense of, here's a, you know, an envelope full of money, but they've still been co-opted because they're ending up actually implementing ideological imperatives over the quest for the truth.
Yeah. And it is happening. The situation that we're in now, more and more, as you say, the more urgency there is to talk about certain things, the harder it is to actually talk about them. Then, in that situation, it seems like more and more people are becoming unwitting operatives as well, you know. So I mean, possibly mentioned about having been in one case publicly disowned as a friend on Facebook over my views on transgenderism, which were as mild as basically saying I agreed with Graham Linehan that women should be regarded as a biological category. And that was enough to be considered completely beyond the pale by a former friend of mine who, incidentally, has been sucked into the Satanic Temple group.
Wow.
And very, very weird group of people she's found herself in now. And people, friends of mine storming out of this online sphere makes it easier for these things to happen. So friends of mine storming out of WhatsApp group chats because I'll say something questioning the value of wearing a mask, just questioning it, saying, well, I'm not sure about the evidence there, and you can't really blame people for being resistant. That's enough for someone to just storm out. Absolutely,
As a statement, presumably.
I think as a statement, yeah. And that's been happening a lot, that kind of thing. Going back to Eric Davis and the sort of the community that he's part of and that I'm still kind of part of as well in the psychedelic world, basically. That's as much saturated with this schismogenesis as anywhere else. And as I mentioned recently in a comment on our last podcast conversation, I was very dismayed recently to find out that Bruce Parry, who I still have a lot of time for him, I still, I have interacted with him personally. I think he's a really nice guy, has said some really interesting stuff. His work is really interesting, but I was really weirded out and dismayed to find that he'd been associating with both Daniel Pinchbeck and Gail Bradbrook. Mm-hmm. And there's a real lack of accountability. There's a real lack of people like Pinchbeck being held accountable, which is very strange, as we're discussing, because there's also this kind of woke thing about rape culture and, you know, how all men are, you know, potentially rapists and all this sort of stuff. That's a bit of an exaggeration. That's a bit of a straw man argument, actually, but it's more complicated than that. But there is this sort of identity politics culture that's saturating the psychedelic scene. And yet, all Daniel Pinchbeck has to do is sort of preemptively, he just me too'd himself. That's all he had to do. Before anyone else got round to it, he kind of me too'd himself, but in such a way as exonerated himself. So he admitted to some of his crimes, but I suspect not all of them. And you know, the way that you've written about this idea of creating, you know, your brother hiding in plain sight, hiding, disguising himself as this outrageous character in order to throw people off and hide something else, something perhaps much darker going on there. And this other chap that we were talking about, Michael Ellsberg, I think it was.
Yeah.
Really, that's a really interesting case study. I'd like to look more at that. And so for anyone listening, so Michael Ellsberg is an associate of Daniel Pinchbeck, and he, I think his father was some kind of US Air Force character, maybe got involved in the anti-war movement or something.
Wasn't it Daniel?
Daniel Ellsberg.
Daniel Ellsberg was the father, no, the Pentagon Papers guy.
Yeah, that's it, yeah.
Yeah.
Famous
guy. He was even in the recent Spielberg movie. I mean, that was about him, yeah.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that. Interesting. Yeah. So Michael Ellsberg, so comes from this sort of very prestigious family background.
Insert Wikipedia page Michael Ellsberg. Ellsberg was the son of Daniel Ellsberg and Patricia Marks Ellsberg, the daughter of American toy maker Louis Marks. He has a brother, Robert Ellsberg, who is a publisher and an author, and a sister epidemiologist, Mary Ellsberg, half-brother of those. He grew up in Berkeley and attended a prestige school, Deerfield Academy. He's written about the power of body language. His first book, The Power of Eye Contact, Your Secret for Success in Business, Love and Life, 2010. His second book, The Education of Millionaires, It's Not What You Think, and It's Not Too Late, 2011, for which Ellsberg interviewed millionaires and billionaires who do not have college degrees, Pink Floyd's David Gilmour among them. The book was profiled in Time magazine, who called the book an assault on higher education, and in the New York Times. Ellsberg also writes for Forbes magazine. He's credited for inventing eye-gazing parties, a craze in 2010, where participants stare deeply into each other's eyes and follow up as they feel they made a connection. He's also a book editor and has spoken at Google and Peter Thiel's Fellow Retreat.
And he gave a workshop at Breaking Convention, the psychedelic conference in Greenwich, 5 years ago, which my certain friends of mine who were directly involved in organizing the conference at that time received complaints about this workshop, and it was on it was called The Sexy Psychodrama of the Absurd. And what it consisted of, apparently, I wasn't there, so I can't vouch for it, but apparently what it consisted of was clips of him engaging in quite fairly extreme sadistic fetish sort of behavior with severely traumatized young women, and kind of playing roles of family members. So essentially I would gather doing BDSM on young women and then getting them to call him daddy, mm-hmm. in essence, as part of a sort of ostensibly reenacting some sort of trauma to theoretically overcome it.
And this was an art exhibit, or this was a demonstration of a therapeutic method?
It was the latter, yeah. So it was part of a workshop that he gave, in which he talked about his work that he did with these traumatized young women, as he called the sexy psychodrama of the absurd. But he's a very, there's not much about him online, I've found. And some of the more dubious stuff has disappeared. There was a blog that was quite severely critical of him, but it was one of those blogs where it's clearly written by these people who are completely anonymous. They know loads of people in some kind of scene. And if you're not involved in that scene, you haven't been following the blog from the beginning, you have absolutely no idea what they're talking about. And so I found some sort of shady references to him as being a bit of a sleazeball in that blog, but very little else about him online, except for something that was in New York Times, I think, where he was describing himself as, or trying to portray an image of himself as being someone, a kind of new man who was all into consent, really into consent, like too much into consent, and this idea of asking verbal consent for everything involving a woman or a potential romantic partner,
right.
Which is a very insidious one, because it sounds to a kind of woke young person, it would sound really like that's a really important and valuable thing, because obviously consent is an important and valuable thing. But if you turn it into something entirely verbal, then you can just say, well, I asked her consent. And I've seen this happen, actually. I've seen these kind of Burning Man types. They have this thing about, you know, oh, can I just touch your arm there? Can I just, you know, and if someone sort of does that with enough force and conviction and persuasiveness and doesn't necessarily wait very long for an answer, it's not really, they're not really trying to gain consent. They're using the question as a way of overriding consent. So it's a bit of a sordid game, it seems to me anyway. But he was using this as a way of promoting himself as being this advocate of this new way of being for men, and what in the process his admission was that he had you know, some of the things that he'd done that made him cringe were apparently approaching women on public transport and chatting them up. And I'm fairly sure that this guy has done worse things than that. I don't know that for sure. I don't know him. I don't want to get sued or anything. But
right, but it sounds like he's done worse things than that under the guise of therapy.
Under the guise of therapy, yeah. And that's very strange. And Pinchbeck's sort of return into the scene after having caused a bit of a fuss when he sort of me too'd himself preemptively, and then there were calls to have him removed as a speaker from things, and then some of that happened, some of it led to him being cancelled or pulled from. But then it gets mixed up with all this thing about this stuff about cancel culture, and it's an interesting one because you go, well, no, but it isn't the same. It's not the same. This man is an self-acknowledged sexual predator who has admitted to using, having drugged women in order to seduce them, has had a couple of rape allegations thrown at him over the years. They haven't really come to the surface much. And that is no way the same. That's no way the same as, you know, banning J.K. Rowling from Twitter or whatever it is. You know, whatever it is people want to do now.
It would be more along the lines of not enabling a predator, I think.
Yes.
Based on what you've said, if he's using his status and his clout to stalk and abuse women, then withdrawing some of that power from him would seem to be something different than just trying to redact unpleasant elements of the psychedelic scene.
Yeah, and it's not about his views being incorrect particularly. It's not a question of his, you know, being politically incorrect or whatever it is. I mean, this is about his energetic behavior, and there's no indication that he's really reformed that. For me, it doesn't seem very likely that he's made any headway in actually resolving whatever it really is. I mean, he claimed it was to do with his trauma as a young child and being forced into having enemas by his mother and aunt or something like that, and very possibly that's true to some extent. I wouldn't be surprised if he is an extremely traumatized man, but again, the way in which he delivered it, there was an energetic sense by which he was trying to deflect the whole deflect the scrutiny away from him by trying to generate sympathy and saying, well, the reason that I'm abusive and predatory is because, you know, they made me have enemas when I was a tiny child. And that's a bit of a dodgy one.
Have you met him?
Briefly, yeah. He actually, he gave a talk at Watkins Bookshop. And myself, Anthony Peake, and the now late Brian Murray went along. And Brian Murray was, who passed away a year or two ago now. Brian Murray was a theatre director who was also a friend of Priestley, and had been, at the time of his passing, had been working on a production of an unpublished Priestley play, which is still in the process of that. There are some other people who are picking up on that now. But anyway, Anthony had made some contact with Daniel at that point, and took me and Brahim along to this talk. And I met Daniel Pinchbeck briefly before the talk, shook his hand and said hello. When was that? Probably about four years ago now. I think this was before he made these admissions about himself. I'd encountered him before at Breaking Convention. I found every talk he gave, I just actually could not listen. I can't listen to his voice. If I just switch off. Because I remember quite vividly once at the Breaking Convention 5 years ago, Daniel Pinchbeck was droning on, and I only realized that I'd completely drifted away when my friend William turned to me and said, "That's not true." And I went, "What isn't true? Sorry, I wasn't wasn't paying attention." But yes, so long story short, I have met Daniel Pinchbeck, and I mean, he was very seemed very civil and courteous to me at that time. But I never got anything out of listening to him speak. And me and Braham afterwards, I remember me and Braham afterwards just talking to each other about how inconsequential it seemed as a talk. Just the stuff that people have been saying in the counterculture for decades, and that has never ever gone anywhere particularly fruitful, of just, there's we're on the edge of a great paradigm shift, and we're all going to become this one unified world family, and psychedelics are going to help us to achieve that great transformation towards a new. It's just
Think
all
it,
this.
do you think he's a lifetime actor then, Pinchbeck?
Well, yeah, I mean, he's got the background for it.
That's what I was thinking, yeah. Because I've met him too, as you know. One same time I met Eric Davis, and we even were on a panel together, Rushkoff, Davis, me, and Pinchbeck. It seems as though, and I was only on that thing because of Pajama Surf. I mean, somehow Pajama Surf got big enough to arrange or be part of something like that that had the clout to pull in Rushkoff and these other, or Pinchbeck at least, and Davis is closer to my level, but certainly I was definitely the small fry on that thing. And I haven't been invited since. And Pajama Surf, well, I had a kind of, had a direct personal relationship with those guys, and they sold the site since then. So it's almost as though there was a small window of opportunity there. I was even put up at the Hilton, where I somehow got included in a kind of social engineering event, let's say, just for the sake of shorthand. And not that I was a spanner in the works or anything. I don't think I disrupted anything, and I don't think I had much impact, to be honest. But I did get to meet these guys, and I spent a little time with Pinchbeck. He was the first person whose hand I refused to shake, because I wasn't shaking hands the whole time, but he was actually the first person who I ran into in the Hilton. So he was the first person I said, "I'm not shaking hands," and he said something about crystals, that I could work with crystals for my energy. I don't even remember what it was. I also recall talking to Eric about Pinchbeck, and unfortunately, I can't remember the specifics of what Eric said. Probably wouldn't want me to repeat them anyway, but I know that Eric had acknowledged some suspicion about Pinchbeck. I mean, even what, I would say some paranoid awareness about Pinchbeck. And that, knowing me, I would have said something like, "Is he CIA?" And I'm pretty sure that Eric was open to that possibility. Let's just put it that way. I don't want to get sued either. And so my impression of Pinchbeck was that he, because I couldn't help myself, even though I've never particularly admired him or his work, his status, and maybe he, projected status as well. I did respond to it in some way. I did kind of want him to like me and stuff, because he was a minor celebrity. So I was probably giving out the right signals in terms of him being, he was, quite friendly and open towards me. I would say he's quite charismatic, because I did find myself liking him even though I knew better. I feel like I know better. There's something that I quite liked about him. I also felt a little bad, a bit sad for him. I felt like he was quite an unhappy person who was locked into, you know, a persona. Anyway, those are just my impressions. But the sort of larger point or question is, you know, what's it like to be on the periphery of that? So Pinchbeck, to stay on him as a case study, as you say, he's got the background. He started out in Rolling Stone. I mean, obviously we've been doing something before that, but in his CV, the Rolling Stone seemed to be that was his first kind of high status position, and that is pretty high status. And he went from Rolling Stone to being this best-selling author. So he never really had, he's a New York intelligentsia set, whatever that was. I don't know his actual background, but I'm pretty sure he had family connections and so on. You don't get a job at the Rolling Stone just because you're a good writer, and he's not even. So there is that. I mean, how did Daniel Pinchbeck become Daniel Pinchbeck? I remember it was actually in a Watkins magazine, coincidentally. They had a list of 100 most influential people on the spiritual scene, and Pinchbeck was in there, and I think he was nearer the top than the bottom. And I remember whenever that was, in the early 2000s, being surprised by that. Like, you know, Pinchbeck, you know, how did he exactly, what did he do? He wrote a book here and a book there. But really, how did he get so influential? Bit of a mystery, but because he was influential, because I sensed that about him, I had reached out to him various times over the years, and we had a correspondence briefly during my Being the One period, which I guess was the same time he believed he was Quetzalcoatl. I believed I was Lucifer. So there you go. We had notes to compare, though we didn't really get into that. It must have been before I read. 2012, because, you know, I was very super critical of that, of the last part of that book, and then later he accepted some of Aeolus Caffer's work at Reality Sandwich. So we've had a somewhat friendly collaboration over the years, but it's never turned into any kind of real alliance, far from it. So it's just interesting to me, I mean, particularly as far as you're concerned, because somehow I've managed never to get, I could say, recruited, never to get promoted, never to get accepted into any kind of set. Like I say, that you know, Reality Sandwich, an article here and there, this Mexican thing with Rushkoff and Pinchbeck, I was really the black sheep there. Like, I just felt palpably I was kind of the odd man out. So here and there I've had these moments of participation in some sort of social subculture. Even my friendship with Tony Peake for a while, you know, while he was angling his way in. And it's very subjective, what's inside, what's outside. But anyway, that's my perception of it. So I don't have the experience that you've recounted in a couple of ways, and we haven't really got into it a lot, but in your emails, number one, of more kind of inside experience of that world, participation in it, and number two, I think inseparably, this feeling of walking on eggshells, because you're seeing things that you're not supposed to see, because you're saying things you're not supposed to say. It's probably a third thing now. Is it hear no evil, see no evil, speak no evil? Hearing things that maybe you shouldn't hear because it's not clear whether you're trustworthy or not.
Yeah, I mean, I ended up really involved with the Breaking Convention crowd, and the Breaking Convention is a good kind of nexus point for, you know, it's become one of the main global psychedelic sort of gatherings on the, at least the intellectual academic level in the world. And that grew out of work that my friends at university were doing. So it was the brainchild of my friend Dave King, who I'm still really good friends with. He works in, he's worked in drug policy stuff for quite a few years now. And him and another friend of mine, Cameron Adams, who is at that time was working in the anthropology department at the University of Kent, they hatched this. Well, they hatched the idea for a conference, which was also part of the original Student Psychedelic Society, which Dave founded, Dave King founded alongside my friends, Ollie Genbash and Jacob Brandt, back in 2010. And I was involved in that because they were, you know, mates of mine, and, you know, we'd hang out together and, you know, get drunk and get stoned and all the rest of it, and be students together and have, you know, intoxicated philosophical discussions and bantering and everything like that. And we're all interested in psychedelics. That was a big thing that brought us together, amongst many other things of, you know, shared interest in music and culture and sort of, you know, various, you know, sort of sense of humor and just the way that people are brought together, just like, oh, you're my kind of person, I'll hang out with you. Mm-hmm. And that they set up the Psychedelic Society, which was the first student psychedelic society in Britain, probably one of the first in the world. If I'm not mistaken. But
so who set it up, sorry?
So three guys, Dave King, Ollie Genbash and Jacob Brandt, all of whom are still in close contact with me, you know, all really good friends of mine, or, you know, old long-standing buddies of mine. And so...
Wow.
Dave King also ended up helping to start Breaking Convention, which was originally held at the University of Kent. Now it's moved to Greenwich. And so Breaking Convention is an interesting one that I definitely felt really a part of at one point. I really felt at home. Three years ago, you know, the Breaking Convention that was held in 2017, I was really impressed by and really felt comfortable and happy, and felt like, you know, this is, that there was a lot of my tribe there. There were a lot of people I consider part of my clan.
What is it? I mean, what's their focus? Is it psychedelics only, or?
The Breaking Convention.
Yeah.
Yes, I mean, it's sort of every aspect of of whatever you could call psychedelia.
That breaking, is that a conscious reference to Pinchbeck's Breaking Open the Head, or is that just coincidental?
I don't know, actually. I'm not really sure. I'm not really sure why they called it Breaking Convention, because it doesn't have an immediately obvious reference to psychedelics. And
that's
also
the association it has for me, so.
Yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't thought of that before. Hmm. I mean, it also clashes with the name of an established breakdancing convention as well. So I don't really know why they chose that name. Could have chosen a better one, maybe. But anyway, so I ended up involved in it just through friends of mine at university. I was obviously interested in psychedelics.
Were they also instrumental in starting the convention?
One of them, Dave King, was, and also another very good friend of mine, Cameron Adams.
So, I mean, this was risking being very impertinent here, but whatever. Do you wonder if these good friends of yours, I mean, like the first ever psychedelic society in England, does that not make you wonder that that wouldn't have been an intelligence-backed thing?
It's a very interesting question. Purely because I know them.
Yeah.
And I mean, we have running jokes about being spooks and narcs with each other and stuff. And
yeah.
I mean, I would almost find it quite amusing if it turned out to be true. But you know, it's yeah. I mean, in terms of the student society, no, I don't have any serious suspicion of that. In terms of the conference, I'm sure the conference is saturated with spooks, and but I not the yeah I think the spooky actors in Breaking Convention, obviously I'm biased because you know I don't suspect that any of my the people that I like and get on with, I've generally not, generally don't have a suspicion that they're kind of wittingly, witting spooky actors, if you know what I mean. Yeah, I mean it strikes me as being something that it's an interesting one actually. Now you mention it, yeah, because it is. To some extent, it's an example of something that I've seen just developing around me as a you know as a member of the public, with some friends of mine kind of putting something together, setting something up, you know, and then seeing it kind of balloon, and all of these other interest groups taking, starting to sort of emerge around it. And you know, the funding that's going into not necessarily Breaking Convention, but psychedelic research generally comes from some very surprising areas. And so one of the yeah, a massive investor in the psychedelic research for medical purposes is actually Max Mosley.
Is he related to Oswald?
Yes, son of Oswald Mosley. The husband now. There's an organization called the Beckley Foundation as well, and my two friends of mine, two of the guys from the Psychedelic Society, Dave and Jacob, they worked for the Beckley Foundation. And Amanda Fielding is this very posh sort of, you know, married to somebody in line to the throne, kind of. And Amanda Fielding, she drilled two holes in her head in the 70s, as a way of
Breaking open the head.
open the head. Yeah, exactly.
Trepanning, or whatever it's called.
Yes, yeah.
Right.
And she's a very eccentric character. Her son had to go on the run when the Grenfell Tower caught fire in London a few years ago, because he was the conservative chair for housing in the local government of Kensington at that time. So
Right.
he was sort of in a position of authority, which would be considered make him a target.
Criminally negligent, or
Yeah, of make him a target for the protest that sparked up around that. And so yeah, it's very, he gets involved, like there's it goes all the way up to the, you know, the British ruling class and the sort of a very much a surprising amount of aristocratic people. Well, it's not necessarily surprising once you know a bit more about this stuff, but yeah, the very, very, you know, wealthy elite people in
Well,
Britain.
even if you trace it back as well, I mean, obviously, McKenna and the Rockefellers, but then you go back to Huxley, the Huxleys and even Havelock Ellis, early psychedelic use,
Fabian.
So generally it seems to be there is an aristocratic interest.
Did you mention McKenna and the Rockefellers there?
Yeah, McKenna was funded by the Rockefeller, wasn't he?
Really? What in what capacity? What was he doing?
I think they bought him a research centre, or I can't remember. It's not a big secret.
All right. Okay. Oh, I wasn't aware of that. That's interesting.
Yeah, he received received money from the Rockefeller Foundation.
But it gets into this question of what is an operative and what is an actor.
Hello there.
Well, yes, it occurred to me, and maybe we should bookmark this because it's a bigger subject, and I want you to continue with the timeline, but it occurred to me that I tried to start movements in my 20s, and now I look back and think, thank God, you know, they would have made perfect vehicles for intelligence, you know, honeypots for intelligence agencies to manipulate. So presumably that's more consistently how they would operate. They've already seeded the culture, so just wait until those who've really taken the programming carry the memes into some sort of action, create their little society, and then it's a genuinely grassroots thing that becomes useful later on. That seems much more plausible to me than
and it also ties in going back to the chronology in a moment, but it does tie in with something like Extinction Rebellion.
Right.
As I've discovered, you know, some other friends of mine have kind of ended up part of the crew that started Extinction Rebellion, and knowing the crew that started Extinction Rebellion.
Right.
And I sent an email with the article I wrote about exile, and a few other deeper queries about exile that I hadn't put into the article that I will raise up in a future writing, I'm sure. But I raised this to one of the co-founders who I know. So I know, a person that ended up, you know, helping to set up XR in the beginning, two, 3 years ago. And I wrote her this email. She wrote back with some replies, which I didn't really find very satisfying. So I kind of dug a bit deeper with my questions and explained a bit more. And it was really obvious to me that she didn't really know who the people she was working with really were, what their backgrounds were, and or what the nature of the movement was. It seemed really obvious to me. When I kind of started to probe a little bit and dig a bit more, the email exchange stopped.
Right.
Just with that follow-up email from me, just going, right, okay, so you're not aware that Gail Bradbrook was, who you work with closely, Gail Bradbrook was working with the Institute for Public Policy Research. You're not aware that she claimed to have no knowledge of who Richard Coleman was, who was a ExxonMobil executive that joined, that was working with Bradbrook in her charity, Citizens Online. She claimed not to know who he was, which is an indication, at least, of a certain lack of attentiveness on her part. But I would say that most likely she knows very well who Richard Coleman is. She's just trying to kind of cover her tracks. And even more, you know, the other guy, Roger Hallam. So the two co-founders of XR, who seem to be the really driving forces behind the movement. You've got Gail Bradbrook, who's a very, seems like an utterly vacuous human being to me. She was at Breaking Convention last year, and I had no sense of any authenticity or any capacity for authentic human expression, at least. Don't know about her in her experience, but she's worked with, you know, she's was working as a kind of tech lobbyist, basically a lobbyist for the tech industry, ostensibly with the aim of bringing more disabled and vulnerable citizens of Britain online. But the actual remit of the charity is much weirder and vaguer than that, and they've issued all kinds of documents in which they write in this very corporate newspeak sort of language, but it's very clear that the idea is to shape the thinking of the population through digital technology.
Right.
Through what they call media literacy. And Roger Hallam, his background is he was, I don't know if he still is, but he was studying a PhD at King's College on nonviolent resistance movements. And I pointed out that you know, his background was in, you know, he studies essentially US-backed, probably CIA-backed, or certainly other wings of the American Intelligence Service adjacent to the CIA, uprisings in the world that were consistent with the aims of US foreign policy. And my contact in XR just claimed complete ignorance and just don't even know what you're talking about. He studies nonviolent resistance. What do you mean? And I came back and just said, you know, well, his interest is in the work of Gene Sharp, who was a theorist, an American political theorist of nonviolent resistance, who was working with various US intelligence agencies, and whose work inspired an organization that still exists called Canvas, or that I think it's the Can. No, the Center for Applied Nonviolent Activist Strategy, or something like that. They're based in Serbia, and they grew out of the movement that eventually helped to overthrow Slobodan Milosevic. Was it Slobodan Milosevic in Serbia? Wasn't it? Yeah.
Don't know.
I think so. Anyway, but anyway, the guy that the Americans didn't like, basically, was thrown out partly due by this youthful rebellion against him.
Right.
Anyway, Roger Hallam studies these kinds of movements, and yes, so drawing it back to what we were talking about, I've had a conversation with my friend who knows our mutual contact in XR, and he was saying, well, I've kind of seen this develop from almost from the inside. I've just seen it as friends of mine getting together and doing this, suddenly getting involved in this environmental campaign. And I suppose I can see that that's maybe a comparable situation with Breaking Convention, though I think Breaking Convention still isn't quite as obvious, like a clear example of just blatant social engineering. Not that it's not an example of social engineering, but XR just seems to me, just instantly, as soon as I heard about it, just red flags just went off. Whereas Breaking Convention, I can also see as plausibly, there's lots of people interested in psychedelics, whether you see that as a product of social engineering or not, but there's a sincerity there. So I guess what I see is, in terms of my contacts in the psychedelic scene, I've seen nothing. My friends within the psychedelic scene, I've seen nothing in them or their behavior to indicate anything less than the total kind of earnestness and sincerity, and a general, my energetic reading of them is a positive one. Whereas all I can say from my own experiences is that looking at certain people like Gail Bradbrook or Daniel Pinchbeck, my energetic experience of them is very different. There's something I've always found Pinchbeck to be a very kind of creepy and weird guy, although also kind of likable, as you say, when I actually met him very briefly. But when I actually did meet him, he seemed, you're right, he seemed like almost someone that I could warm to. It was very confusing for me, because I knew that I also thought he was not someone to be particularly admired or trusted, and also someone who, every time I've seen him speak, I've just switched off. So where am I going with all this? So we were talking about kind of being an operative, maybe unwittingly, and movements being started.
And just, well, the larger question was, how are you situated in this community, and why, and do you want to get out, or do you want to stay in, and so what, in what capacity, and how precarious does it feel?
Yeah, I mean, well, to sort of zoom in on Breaking Convention is a good, and the return to it is a good nexus point. My feeling after the last one was, I don't really want to go back there. I don't want to speak there. I want to have don't want to have too much to do with it anymore. In terms of I don't I yeah I mean I don't have a strong fit in the broader sense of like the psychedelic scene is in people who are interested in psychedelics. I don't have a strong aversion to that. You know, I'm still happy to be broadly associated with that culture, you know, and I'm not averse to the use of these substances in my own life at this point anyway. I may change in the future. I go right, I'm not touching them anymore. But you know, I still do dabble in them from time to time. So yeah, I don't have an intense aversion to the kind of the grassroots of it. It's all right to me. I can see some aspects of the broader culture that are naive and kind of very easily make people very easy to manipulate for all kinds of nefarious purposes. But in terms of the actual people, you know, I still have lots of nice interactions with people who probably describe themselves as being psychedelic types and hippie types. And yeah, it's just sort of the sort of milieus that I float around in. Here in Canterbury, it's such a small town. That and there's a certain earthiness about the local alternative scene as well. You know, it's doesn't take itself too seriously. The people are very humble. I think humility is something that I find an important gauge of, you know, the kind of people I know in the area. And in, you know, the friends of mine who are interested in this scene, they're not really interested in blowing their own trumpet and being the next big thing. You know, they're just kind of doing their thing. And they might be even quite active and ambitious in a sense. And, you know, I've got, you know, a friend of mine runs a psychedelic press, publishing house, and, you know, I've got, yeah, I've got friends who do these things quite actively and would be less cynical about the whole scene than I am, for example. But there isn't this kind of, I don't get this feeling of this need to be a guru, need to be the big thing, or to fall in line too greatly with all of these other issues. When you see all this collection of this particular collection of issues all coming together, psychedelics can help fight climate change and transphobia, probably this kind of thing. That always makes me wary. I'll put it like that.
Well, it's occurring to me that generally it seems as though generally movements and communities they tend to center around something that's transcendental, whether it's literally transcendental in the sense of God, so monastic communities, for example, and obviously religious cults. Obviously, they center around God, the idea of God and a doctrine and a dogma and so on. But then, thinking more about audience cults here, you're familiar with Bainbridge, I guess, at least a little bit from Prisoner Infinity, William Sims Bainbridge, the Pentagon advisor and the transhumanist, and he wrote about the Process Church way back, but then more recently he's written about transhumanism as the Church of God Galactic, and also audience cults as the use of UFO. He looked into UFO as a useful, this is in changing images of man as well, perhaps less explicitly.
Right, that's where I recognize his name, because he co-wrote it with Willis Harmon.
No, he. I don't think he was actually involved with Changing Images of Man, but there's just overlaps between the two researchers, the two
Right.
bodies of research. What was I saying? And that, yeah, so the utility of audience, the utility of the UFO for creating audience cults with a sort of transcendental orientation, in a sense, but at the same time they would gather together as these little cults and communities that could then be put to use in other ways, for whatever, the various different ways that you can imagine that an audience cult could be used. So it was occurring to me that the psychedelic is like that. It's like the UFO. It's a pseudo transcendental object around which an audience cult can gather. And herein, I think, lies the danger. Because what does a psychedelic-based community do besides take psychedelics, which is just, maybe it's all right. We've already covered this, so we won't go into it. But even if we say that that's maybe sometimes all right, what then? All that's left then is keep taking them, or you're no longer part of it, or promoting psychedelic use. And then, as you say, the different not ramifications, but like apps that you can add on. Oh, psychedelics can heal trauma. Oh, psychedelics can cure bigotry. And psychedelics are a connection to the divine. Obviously, it's the big central one. That's the I'd say that's the MacGuffin there. And all of that, I think, points to a danger or a misconception. Is that because if psychedelics are an aid in some way? Well, I don't know. I mean, we'll put that a question mark. We've got traditions, shamanic traditions, but are these audience cults the equivalent of those? Even if we're going to put a question mark over the psychedelic traditions. I mean, Marcel Aliard believed that that was a debasement of shamanic practices when they started using entheogens, not and what are now called entheogens. I shouldn't even use that. Suggestogens is Jan Irvin's term, but anyway, the plants and the synthesis, the synthesized substances. Well, it wouldn't have been synthesized for the shamans, it would have just been plants. That was, a degeneration of the rituals. That's one theory. So even there, we put a question mark. And then, is it are the movements now even closely approximate to that aboriginal learning and application of it? I would say very, very unlikely. It doesn't seem like it at all. So then, what are they? And are they not much closer to Spain Bridges and Harman's idea of audience cults and creating changing images of our evolutionary potential as a way to regenerate the superculture and maintain the same power structures by transforming them? And then the evidence being, well, what are the kind of philosophies and thought memeplexes that are being created around the psychedelic? So you've got Pinchbeck, he's an example. You've got McKenna, another good bad example. Tony Peake, he hasn't even taken the damn things, but he's writing books about them, which I presume he considers a complementary with his Damon Edelon thesis, with his Philip K. Dick interest. I don't remember what else Tony's into, maybe afterlife, near-death experiences, I don't know. But it's this second matrix of kind of materialized spirituality, I would say. The attempt to scientifically create scientific blueprints for spiritual development, human potential, back to Aldous Huxley, aren't we? So somehow I just see it's all the usual suspects in there. Rattling around, like nails in a barrel. And so it's almost separate from, can these plants be good for us sometimes? Okay, maybe they can. It seems to me that's pretty much separate at this point from that certain concerted interests have seen that it could be used, just like the UFO or even Christianity for that matter, for social engineering as a way to create these movements like Extinction Rebellion, to divert genuine awakenings into and harness that power as like a fuel source. So I guess that's my question. Like, if any of that's true, or I mean, if you're on the edge of seeing things like that yourself, at least you're talking to me. What kind of position are you going to be in? Because you could very quickly start becoming persona non grata. If you, like you say, if you question the mask wearing, well, boom, you're out. Well, if you question psychedelics, you may find you're less and less welcome, and you also may find you've got more and more of an imperative or responsibility to question it.
I mean, you know, in terms of my friends within the scene, you know, I've publicized our recent podcast together.
How did it go down?
Yeah, it was very well received, actually. Yeah, and had one message from good friend of mine who's in, you know, came to Breaking Convention last year and sent me a message saying, yeah, I really enjoyed it and was really, really find it important to have this kind of critical angle on these things. So I think there's an openness in the people who I consider the more sensible and grounded members of the psychedelic scene, very much an openness to the dangers of these things. At least as in principle, at least a sense of like, yeah, actually, you look at the history of the CIA, you look at Gordon Wasson, you look at all this MK Ultra stuff. It doesn't look good, you know. It's not quite the countercultural dream of, you know, suddenly everyone started dropping acid and was turned on. But then again, you know, there's an element of that. I think there is possibly some kernel of truth in that countercultural dream narrative as well. And I'm, you know, an interesting figure actually is Robert Forte, who I've corresponded with, and I'm not sure if I agree with everything, with his take on it in all forms. I mean, he's quite a fan of Timothy Leary, who I find very suspect, and he actually knew Timothy Leary quite well. But his angle on it is, you know, that these things can be used as great awakening tools, or at least medicines for the soul in some way, but that wasn't the overriding, you know, that wasn't the purpose of the CIA, and certainly that the counterculture was very much largely driven by these forces. And his take on it is that Timothy Leary went rogue, as it were. Timothy Leary was an operative that went off the rails,
right,
and saw through the program and decided to try and disrupt it. But I mean, he's someone who's, you know, he described psychedelics to me as being kind of like a fairy dust thrown into the eyes of the radical movement of the 60s, just to sort of blind them. And then everyone's tripping out, and of course they're in a state of complete kind of chaos and confusion, and the disorder that arises from that, I think, can also be, I'm not saying it's good, but at the very least it has an authentically anarchic and uncontrollable aspect that I think that certain factions of the establishment did not like, and that my suspicion is that's why they were banned and clamped down on, is when it was sort of, it was this experiment. It was like, well, okay, well, these things are cool. Let's try them out for mind control and torture and just seeing what they do. Let's see what we can do with this stuff. And, let's see if we can make little microcosmic mind control cults just to experiment with how that behavior might work on the macrocosmic level, like what may have happened with Charles Manson and people like that. And I suspect a lot of the other cult leader types as well. There is an aspect of it that was just, you don't really, there's not really much. Okay, once you've got the anti-war movement completely derailed by a bunch of naked hippies dancing around, you've kind of done as for now. All right, we'll put the lid on that for now. We don't need to do any more of this for now. Maybe we can revive it in 60 years' time. But let's put a dampener on it. And I think particularly it's there's a different context in Britain and America as well. I think America, my suspicion is, and I have not, I don't have much to back this up on, but my suspicion is that the American military and intelligence services were much more interested in psychedelics than the British ones. That's just, I could be wrong. And as you say, there's also, there's the Fabian Society, there's Havelock Ellis, huge British countercultural psychedelic movement. Princess Margaret was tripping out. But I think that there's an element of the British countercultural scene that was always just, it couldn't really be controlled. So it had to be kind of pushed down on. So there was the Stonehenge Free Festival being an example of that, as something that was just stopped in the mid 80s dead. Thatcher government just went, right, we're not having that anymore. And I'm not even saying that it was necessarily a completely positive thing, because I don't think that the kind of chaotic scenario of travelers and crusties and hippies and wreckheads all descending on this one ruined site that none of us really know or understand the original context or purpose for which it was built, but it's just a impressive object that's mostly fallen to bits in the British landscape. Descending on that, a completely unregulated and regulated is a bad word, but sort of very unruly and reckless and immature party. But at the same time, I don't think that at that time was in the interests of many, at least many factions in the establishment. It was just too chaotic. It's like, no, we can't have that happening because that's a bit much. It's much more like I can see it in terms of things like MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. They're getting MDMA. It's in stage three of its clinical trials in America now for PTSD, for treating war veterans, which is a point that Bob Forte has made many times, is that, well, okay, you've got the military industrial complex, but that's all right. If it traumatizes you, you can just take some MDMA and then, you're fine. And I saw recently actually a Metro article, which was the headline was something like, "Meet the women who are using magic mushrooms to tackle lockdown anxiety." And I shared that on my Facebook account with a quote from Aldous Huxley about using pharmacological means to make people love their servitude. It's the most obvious example of that. It's just, okay, well, this horrendously bizarre situation we find ourselves in might be giving you anxiety, but that's okay because we have psilocybin mushrooms to help.
Yeah, well, they legalized cannabis here in Canada just months before the lockdowns
Oh,
began.
really? Oh, okay. I didn't know. That's interesting. Yeah.
Two embers in the fire faced one another. Said to the other, "What are you doing here?" Although I question carefully your presence, I am so grateful for your company in the fire. Until we're gone, 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 gone. Gone, 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 gone. Gone, 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 gone. When the flames have all burned down, what will burn to ash. Throw the ash down, let the trees grow once again. And from trees you cut the wood to build your fire. So build your fire and let it all burn down again. Until it's gone, 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 gone. Gone, 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 gone. Gone, 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 gone. When the flames have all burned down, what will remain? Sit, reflect, accept the heat you feel. Though it burns you through. In fire, the flame you are is revealed. This is the change. And you're gone, 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 gone. Gone, 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 gone. Gone, 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 gone. When the flames have all burned down.
A lot of it, I don't really like it when people boil everything down to money, because I think there's more to money. Is itself a symbol of something else, which is power and status and influence, and that's a whole, you know, it's much more subtle than that. But there is a huge amount of money potentially to be made in cannabis, pharmaceutical products from made from psychedelics, you know, psychedelic research. There's just a lot of money in this stuff. And so an aspect of it is just the sheer, it's like, well, we're at a kind of dead end. I forget which, was an American comedian, black comedian, might have been Michael Che, who said, when all these American states were legalizing weed, that's when you know the economy is in a bad way. The governors, the states go, well, shit, you know, nothing else for us but to sell weed now. So you've just reached the last end, you know, you've reached the dead end. It's like, okay, right, well, let's start selling acid to people. Maybe we can revive the economy that way. Cannabis probably more so an economic revival. I hear rumors from those who are involved in these things of the plan is that once Britain leaves the European Union, and you know the economy is in a complete mess, that we'll legalize cannabis and then become another kind of Holland and have all these, you know, tourist coffee shops like in Amsterdam, and that will apparently revive the economy again. I don't know if that's
And
true.
Amsterdam, meanwhile, the Dutch are trying to get Amsterdam back from the tourism, right? Because they're
Yeah.
so sick of that whole scene.
Yeah, they're trying to stop that. I think principally stopping foreigners from having access to it. That seems to be, from the outside anyway, that the Dutch don't really care if weed is legal or not in their own country because, to be honest, most of them don't smoke it anyway. They're not actually that interested. There's a small group of Dutch people who are quite into that stuff, but I don't think they mind so much about Dutch people doing it. It's more that
Yeah, it's the
the tourists.
degenerate foreign element.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but bringing it back to this question that you raised earlier, of the audience cults. Yeah. I suppose the nature of I suppose in terms of what my position is. So I don't really have any position on the psychedelic scene, thankfully, I think.
Except
So
you're in it, so you must have some position.
yeah, so I suppose I'm that's a clumsy way of saying it. I suppose more I don't have a significant any real level of significance. And so there's people who are friends of mine. There's some people who know me and the kind of stuff I do. But you know, that's a fairly I've for what I do, such as it is, at this point, I have a minuscule.
You might influence the influencers, though.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, I mean, you know, I've got certain specific contacts, say Tony Peake or someone like that. But yeah, well, I recently did a podcast with him, actually.
Well, that remind me, I was going to ask you but about your podcast, but first of all, did you finish your review of Tony's book or whatever you're going to do there?
Kind of, yeah. I mean, well, what I gave a sort of bullet point list of some things, some thoughts I had in an
Yeah.
email. I didn't manage to get onto them in the course of our conversation together, but it would be. I'm interested. I've sort of registered some of my thoughts about it, and so it'd be interesting to follow up on it and actually go a bit more deeply into those things because, the recent book seemed to be an interest that it finished on a note. This book, The Hidden Universe, it just finished on a note that, it didn't entirely sit well with me.
So did he respond to your bullet points in the email?
No, not really.
He
So I
didn't. So he
maybe.
just.
Yeah,
Sorry?
maybe we'll get a chance to actually
Yeah.
talk about them at some point.
He knows somewhat what you think, but it hasn't actually, you haven't actually thrashed it out.
Yeah. That'd
Okay.
be one. Yeah.
The other thing I was going to ask about was Lachman. I don't know if it was the first in your podcast, but
That's
certainly
right. Yeah.
it was with Lachman.
Yeah.
So what do you, in brief, because we've only got another 20 minutes or so, how do you feel about Lachman and how did that go?
I enjoyed our chat. Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed both of the conversations I had with Tony and with Gary. Gary, I met at Breaking Convention a few years ago as well. I like him a lot. He's a really sound guy. And we got onto the subject of psychedelics, and it was actually the day or so before or after our last conversation, actually. So I brought up some of the things that we'd been talking about, and you know, his own reservations about the sort of, because I asked him about what he felt about the psychedelic scene, and he kind of, I felt he was sort of trying to be charitable and tactful, but basically what he was saying was sort of, as and of themselves, in terms of being this great agents of world transformation or spiritual expansion, he didn't seem to have that much interest in them. He was just you can kind of tell from his writing, he's just more interested in the history of consciousness and the history of sort of esotericism and this kind of thing in general. And you know, the psychedelic aspect might come in at various points, but I just got that sense that he was sort of was fairly neutral about them, but just wasn't particularly interested. Didn't feel that they should be valorized or placed at the center of anything. Which I guess comes back to this thing of the audience cult. And I suppose that the thing about the psychedelic community, such as it is that there's something about them that something about a lot of these people that I find this kind of affinity with, that I get on with. But that isn't necessarily because they take psychedelics. It might be that there's something else that has drawn us all into that soup. But there's, you know, that centering the psychedelics, as maybe you were hinting a bit earlier, is a gateway for all kinds of other nefarious sort of manipulations.
Yeah, diversions and traps and snares. I mean, what you just said there would be consistent with a honeypot too. You would expect to find some nice, healthy flies like yourself. If you see what I mean, it's designed to draw in. And I mean, my theory about psychedelics and why they were made illegal, what you're referring to earlier, has to do with, it doesn't really, I mean, the main thing is for those of the very small portion of collective humanity that is feeling the splinter in the brain and ancestrally or individually driven to try and find a way out of this delusional state that we're in collectively, that's the demographic that counts. So that's the demographic that's been targeted for sabotage, I would say. So it wouldn't matter, and in fact making them illegal would only strengthen people like you or I, our determination to experiment with those things, because that's actually a kind of way to validate them. There might actually be even a threat to the system if they were legal and just, you know, Bob and Judy and your average person was dropping acid from time to time, because that's kind of the workforce, and for them to become, you know, have their doors of perception shaken might actually make them less dependable as a slave population. So there's that on the one hand, and on the other hand, that the main way in which I think they're destructive is that they trick those of us who are coming into or nearing some sort of awareness into mistaking the finger for the moon, for taking the tool for the actual thing that we're trying to gain access to. That was one thing I wanted to say, and the other, I don't know if it's related, but I'm going to just try and say it anyway, since we're running out of time. As far as being part of an audience cult or associating with individuals who are possibly unconscious operatives, as we've touched on today and in our email exchange, like, if they are helping to build audience cults or little matrices, then they've become unconscious operatives. I would consider myself as that for some time. As I say, for me it never took. Like, none of the things I attempted to get started ever did. So I guess whatever, that was lucky for me. But the way I feel now is that I just feel that time is running out, and so I feel less and less inclined to give the benefit of the doubt. And what it seems to come down to is something very, very similar, but I think not quite the same as taking a moral stance. And my feeling with, and I don't necessarily want to mention names, but some of the names we've mentioned are people who maybe have the good intentions and they're really trying to get to the truth, but somehow for whatever variety of reasons they've hitched their wagon to a kind of Trojan horse for the empire, that what was I going to say, that it has to do with them not taking a moral, they're not willing to take a moral position on anything, and that's in our culture now. And as I said, it's not quite the right frame, because I don't think that the reasons for not for do it for the reasons to question psychedelics is moral, but I think it's the equivalent. I think it's what morality has become the counterfeit for, as in what's actually good for us. And I think that's where I feel like time's running out, just to say, hey Tony, hey Eric, hey Jeff, hey Gary, whoever it is, hey Luke, this may actually be really wrong what you're doing now. So, you know, look into your heart, look into your conscience, because time is running out. And if you're well, I don't want to finish that sentence, but I'm just trying to express how I feel around this. And clearly this is about my own moral culpability and responsibility and accountability, but somehow, because we're all interconnected, that does include attempting to call others to a kind of accountability, say, hey, I think you're accountable here. And it's very, very tricky, because I don't want to be going around trying to pick fights or pointing the finger, you know, casting stones,
mm-hmm.
right? But on the other hand, I don't want to not call bullshit when I see bullshit, because mm-hmm. then I'm enabling the bullshit. Anyway, so that's my little speech.
Oh, interesting and very provocative. Yeah, I mean, it's again the moral stance, I guess, it would refer back to your own lived sense that these things are actually really quite dangerous and really quite harmful. So I mean, I guess we haven't got too much time, but it was something that was I wanted to ask last time, actually. You said something about psychedelics being physically harmful from your own experience. I just wondered what that meant for you.
Okay, well, I mean, the first thing, to start with the really gross thing, was during the time I was doing Salvia Divinorum. It was a period of months and I was doing it every week, and I went to the dentist, I think this is in my piece, and I was fine, and then 3 months later, 3 months of intensive Salvia Divinorum use, I went back to the dentist and I had, I can't even remember, 9 cavities. And I said, well, wait a minute, I was just here 3 months, it was a different dentist. So maybe it was a crap dentist the first time, but it seems unlikely, because dentists, they look for work, right? They look for reasons to charge you. So based on that, if I develop 9 cavities in 3 months while doing intensive Salvia Divinorum, I got to say, well, wait a minute, there's some connection here. And I don't think that the Salvia Divinorum was literally eroding my teeth like candy. So this is very theoretical, but I do theorize, or I did theorize, that there was something to do with the intensification of access to energy, perhaps in the body or outside the body, I don't know, and the overlap between that and access to unconscious matter. Smoke salvia and all this unconscious matter / energy / kundalini, whatever's going on there, / interdimensional entities, is flooding the nervous system and flooding the awareness. So I'm experiencing being a god or being Lucifer or being a multitude of chattering elves or whatever it is. if that is having a corresponding effect on the nervous system, which of course it is because it's happening in the nervous system, then maybe there's a toll, right? Doesn't seem particularly strange to consider there would be a toll, that the body would find it difficult to actually harness and handle and process all of that energy, all of that. And then, okay, so all these cavities, maybe there's a connection there. So that's kind of at the grossest level that I've gone into the subtle there to try and understand it. And then it was some years later when I, you know, post Icarus phase, when I actually, after I'd crash landed, which was sort of unrelated to using psychedelics because it was due to a romantic breakup that was quite traumatic, but it was on the tail end of using psychedelics for many years and stopping using them over a period of time, and that, you know, and in that interim was, and actually before, leading up to Matrix Warrior period, which I've related in Chronicles of a False Awakening, this whole Lucifer possession period where I believed I was the one, and there was a psychotic break in the middle of there where I was quite violent and did some damage. So that, and that was why I stopped using psychedelics, because I realized, okay, being possessed by Lucifer, it might be, you know, quite romantic in theory, but in practice it could be quite dangerous. And so that was what led to me stopping using them. And then a few years after I stopped using them, I really crash landed, like I really came all the way down to earth again. And what I experienced then was a combination of real despair and dejection and how empty my life was. And I was rock bottom. I was back in England on the dole, sick every day, lonely. Like my life, you know, after all these flights, psychonautic travels to the furthest reaches of the universe, inner and outer, I was, you know, I was lower than I'd ever been in every sense, emotionally, psychologically, financially, you know, living next door to my mother and walking her dog. I was just, you know, back to zero. And night sweats and the sense I had during that period was that, okay, now I'm paying the back taxes. I basically turbo boosted my way into these other dimensions, allowing me to cross all these borders where you're supposed to pay your tolls and all the rest of it. But I had no idea. And then once I finally I'm brought back down to earth, then I get all these bills in the mail. All the energy that I had released through the psychedelics and thereby had access to it in a very condensed period of time, therefore had these very intense journeys into the unconscious / you know, the universe, that energy had gone, it had dispersed, because I hadn't been able to regather it, I hadn't been able to harness and channel it. I just had these brief epiphanies and then written books about them, but at a bodily level, I'd just burn an awful lot of energy far too fast, like the candle that burns too brightly. So that was my felt sense and my intuitive and my deductive sense. Okay, so it really burned off a lot of life force that way, and now I'm going to have to regenerate it. / I really accessed an awful lot of unconscious matter, was unable to process it, so now I've got to process it. And it was all about just coming down to earth and just facing the ordinary, you know, very far from psychedelic reality of my reality. And congruent with that, the last point is that I was still on the tail end of these visionary dreams I would have just about every night for years, and astral projection and all that stuff. And so I was still having these, but I started to see that the more far out my dream vision projection, astral projection journeys were, the harder it was in the morning to come back to my body, to wake up, to get up even, because my body felt so spread apart and so just terrible. I mean, I felt like death. I really felt like I was not just dead or dying, but like I was death itself. And that I just every morning I would have to lie there for an hour or 2 hours just bringing the atoms of my energy body back together, because it was just so disrupted by these cosmic visions, that they weren't helping me in any shape or form, except that they gave me mind candy. Mm. They gave me these great stories and great memories and things I could say, wow, I did this last night, or I saw this, or I saw that. So they made me feel really important and special. But that didn't help with my loneliness and my despair, really. It's just sort of like a consolation prize. And it certainly, at a physical level, yeah, I was just a wreck. And this is why I ended up getting a diagnosis of chronic fatigue system syndrome, which I don't attribute that to psychedelics, by the way, because I think that began in my early 20s. Although actually that would coincide with my first LSD trip. So I guess I can't rule that out either. But in any event, I had already had chronic fatigue without really knowing it for 20 years before I was fully diagnosed. But it was only, and I noticed this about weed too, that when I would smoke marijuana every day, I would basically feel good most of the time, physically as well. I'd feel spacious and kind of numb, but in a nice way. Then if I would stop for a week, if I stopped for long enough, I'd start to feel shit and all these symptoms would come back and I'd even get a cold or something. So I realized after a time that smoking weed was a way to shut down my body or my nervous system enough that the symptoms would get suppressed. But once I started cleaning out, they would all come back. And I just wonder, you know, about how specific is that to me? You know, is my biology radically different from other people's? Seems unlikely. So then I wonder about these people who advocate these drugs. Maybe they just do them often enough, regularly enough, they never get to notice, you know, the effects, the side effects, or the deleterious effects, you know, that they haven't yet had the bills for their back taxes come through their mailbox. You know, I seriously wonder that, because I just can't see that I would be so exceptional. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I did a lot, but not compared to some of these guys. So anyway, that's my answer. Hopefully it was comprehensive without being TMI.
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate the... I appreciate the impulse to kind of go, look, guys, come on. Maybe this is dangerous, you know. Just from my own lived experience, I can only meet it to a certain point, you know.
You can only what?
I can only meet it.
Oh, my experience.
Only sort of connect with that up to a certain point.
How many trips have you had, would you say?
Quite a few, I guess. Yeah, quite a few.
More than 20, less than 50.
Yeah, I would say probably more than 50.
And more than 50. Okay. Maybe. So
depends on how you define a trip, I guess, because there's you know, there's variable doses as well. And yeah, I mean, I can certainly see from my experience of having used these things as a means of some sort of spiritual transcendence, that I can see that definitely was harmful to my psyche, maybe to my body as well, I don't know, but certainly to my psyche, and that must have had some relationship with the physical too. So I can certainly meet it there. I can certainly empathize with that. But in terms of just having had some experience of these things and getting a bit more of a sense of what, okay, so it might throw up this kind of radical feeling of bliss. Yeah, that's not God. You know, that's not that's not God in the way you think it is. You know, it's not, that's not enlightenment. Don't pay too much attention to that. It might be enjoyable, but it's not anything lasting or permanent. I don't think these things should be used as kind of transcendent mechanisms, you know, and kind of go back to the Maria Sabina thing, you know, these things are potentially medicinal. So I've found that they've been beneficial and harmful at various points, you know, that sometimes an experience with one of these things can kind of allow you to look at things from a slightly different perspective and hence achieve a bit more space. Maybe going back then to what you were saying about feeling spacious when you're on weed, but I suppose the point is if you're able to function perfectly all right without these things, to me anyway, that would seem to be an indicator that that if there's a kind of moderation, I suppose, you know.
Well, I think there's two separate things here, perhaps. One is what you just zeroed in on, you know, maybe they're somewhat harmful in and of themselves. And even there, I think there's a lot of nuance there, because in my serpent piece, really what I'm writing about there is the disruption of the energy body,
mm-hmm.
which of course affects the physical body. And I suspect that's what I'm talking about in my own experience too, that the way in which I disrupted the configuration of my energy body then had these effects on my physical body, but it doesn't mean that the substances themselves harm the physical body directly. So that's a nuance there that's important. But what I say, the other thing that's somewhat separable from the question of what the effects of the psychedelics themselves is, what we're talking about, whatever they are used as a crystal matrix, or is that the right term, like you use a salt crystal to create a whole matrix around, that they have become like power sources for these audience cults, for these memeplexes. And that was in my exchange with Michelangelo, actually, because he was suggesting that I had such a hard line with the psychedelics because of my own regret around them and so on, and I acknowledged that, but I said it's not just that, it's also that the psychedelic, like the UFO, is now inseparable from edifices of control that include MKUltra and organized child abuse and things that really just about anyone with any kind of integrity would want to take a moral position on. Even if it's not necessarily helpful to take a moral position, but you know what I mean? There's just a visceral sense, this is wrong. And if I'm going to, that's a line that, you know, you're going to cross at your peril, let's say. So that's the other point, that it can get confusing if the two get mixed up, because you know, psychedelics could be proven to have no harm on the physical body and it wouldn't change the use that they're being put to, and that somehow, I mean, Leary's set and setting, the context in which people are both using and promoting psychedelics is going to determine the effects, or influence the effects that they're having also. It's like they've been co-opted into this other larger agenda, which I would say overall is the trauma genetic disembodiment agenda. And that's the one I feel very strongly about. I just feel that is the opposite direction to the one to go in.
So from your perspective, it would be very difficult at the very least to decouple the, you know, the instruments themselves from this kind of audience cult or matrix of audience cults that they've been used to generate.
Like the sacrament, isn't it? Or the wafer. I mean, that only means something because it's all in the context of Christianity. Now, these psychedelics do have an effect independently, perhaps, of what we believe about them, or there may well be a placebo element in there. So they have become a kind of secular sacrament. And I just wonder, I mean, how much energy did I use up with psychedelics? How much meaning and purpose did they give to my life? It's quite a lot, really. And I would say that obviously there are worse things I could have been doing. It goes without saying, but there are certainly better things as well. So even if it's somewhere in the middle of the spectrum, as in there's just as many worse things I could have been doing as there are better things, it's still not that great, is it, really? Certainly not something you'd want to make central to your philosophy of life. And so I think it'd be quite different if you just knew people who did these things once in a while and shared their experiences, but it wasn't a big thing to talk about, and you know what I mean? I mean, that's kind of unthinkable, but it seems as though that would be closer to something I could see might be okay. But it just isn't that. There's a whole philosophy behind them, and they change the way people think. That's the whole point about taking them. They're supposed to change the way you see reality. I just question that.
I mean, certainly that kind of, you know, the taking them once in a while and kind of maybe dropping it into a conversation, but it's not that. That's closer to my experience of them within my circle of people that I hang around with. You know, that kind of, you know, someone saying, "Oh, yeah, I haven't done those for a while. Haven't taken mushrooms and gone for a long walk for a while. So I did that and it was quite nice. And then I came home, had a cup of tea, and then went to bed and got up and did my work." And so things like that. So that's for that reason, I guess, it's you know, it's hard for me at this point to feel that there's this sort of that there's a kind of totality that in the way that, you know, that certainly I think to some extent that definitely I can relate to the idea of them, the sense of them overwhelming the energetic body, particularly things like DMT, as I think we talked about last time. And you know, at a certain point, they're very tiring, I find, as well. They take a lot, they tax a lot. Yeah. So you see the acid casualty type who's just twitching and kind of, you know, as clearly there are physiological conditions that have been generated by their use of these things over the years, repeatedly over and over again. And so... yeah. But then, you know, with people kind of using them kind of there's a gray area of nuance as well between recreation and medicine too, of, you know, maybe that's my modern Western countercultural socially engineered bias talking. I don't know, I can't rule it out, but there's something to maybe the idea that there can be something healthy and healing about a pleasant experience with, you know, I'd focus on something like psilocybin, partly because it just grows naturally everywhere, almost everywhere anyway, just sort of comes out of the ground people have been picking it and taking it for a long time, but not to, I think, not to put it on a pedestal. I think that's where it gets dodgy for me anyway, is centralizing it and putting it on a pedestal, turning it into an agent of spiritual transcendence or even God, and then, you know, attempting to incorporate it into the broader stream of sort of the kind of corporate mechanistic world in which we find ourselves. And I think there's something similar, maybe could be said about the green movement, or, you know, the ecology movement. There's something authentically, we like other life forms, and we like functioning ecosystems, and we like to be around nature and trees and everything, and that's an authentic and, I would say, quite healthy thing, but it's being also used to actually promote the opposite.
It gets fetishized on its way, doesn't it? It's fetishized, and then it gets weaponized.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, there's a weaponization of psychedelics going on, for sure. And that I would very much say we need to be very aware of that and very vigilant. But, you know, I'd say that my mate Matthew, who lives on the other hill, kind of, you know, every now and then sort of taking some mushroom tea, going for a walk through the countryside, I don't think that's too harmful for him from my own perspective, but I don't know. Yeah.
Between Matthew and his mushrooms,
yeah.
We won't intrude on that territory. The end of my conversation with Luke Dodson. If you'd like to read Luke's piece on Extinction Rebellion and the shadowy forces inside or behind it, click on the link in the show notes and take you to Luke's blog. I believe that's the last podcast I have currently, which doesn't mean there won't be one next week, but if so, I don't know what it will be or who it will be with. So watch this space. And if you want to encourage, support, amplify the signal of this podcast, keep it renewing itself, then there are a number of ways that you can do that. I'll leave it to your imagination. You probably know the drill by now. That's it for The Liminalist between all the podcasts. Signing off, Jarson Horsley at horticulture.com.
Thank you.